Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When a survivor of sexual assault decides to report the crime, DNA evidence can make or break an investigation. But these meticulous medical exams can be taxing and re-traumatizing, and the rape kit backlog continues to be an issue statewide. Today on Insight, we'll explore solutions to process these exams faster. Later in the hour, we'll also discuss the severe drought that has put 41 counties in a drought emergency, how it's affecting agriculture, and how farmers are trying to adapt. But first, wildfire prevention, that was one of the biggest issues at the top of Governor Gavin Newsom's list. His goal was to overhaul wildfire prevention efforts when he signed an executive order on his first full day in office. With the drought, looming high temperatures, and after last summer's fires sparked by rare lightning storms, we're preparing for the possibility, yet again, for one of the worst fire seasons in California's history. So, with two devastating wildfire seasons behind us, just how much was done with this executive order. Joining us now with his investigation is CAP Radio's state government reporter, Scott Rodd. Welcome back to Insight, Scott.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, Scott, before we dive really deep into your investigation, let's just set the scene for us. What is the state of wildfires in California, and how has the state's approach to addressing wildfires changed?
As you mentioned, last year was a record-setting year for California. Over 4 million acres burned statewide. That's the most on record. And, previous years in the last decade also set records. So we've sort of been bumping up what we've seen as the most burn year after year. And this year, as you mentioned again, it threatens to be another catastrophic wildfire season. Going back a bit further, we've had a century of fire suppression. That has been the approach of wildland firefighters for the duration of the 20th century. And that worked for a while to get fires under control, but it resulted in fuels being built up. And that, coupled with climate change, has resulted in a situation where we're seeing these massive, huge conflagration fires that we weren't seeing 20, 30 years ago. And, that means that California, along with the rest of the nation and other countries, are coming to terms with a transformation in thinking about firefighting, where fire isn't always necessarily bad. It's a natural event that has to happen. And instead of just reacting by fighting fire and trying to put it out as soon as it breaks out, they're now prioritizing prevention. So trying to do things that would essentially stop the fires before they start, thinning forests and doing prescribed burns, using fire in a good way to try to prevent these major fires out from breaking out.
Going back to the governor's first full day in office, he talked about reining in on wildfires and made a promise with that executive order. Can you just run us through, remind us of what those promises were back in 2019?
Sure. On his first full day in office, he held a press conference surrounding by emergency response folks and wildfire firefighters and CAL FIRE officials up in the Sierra foothills. And here's what he said about fighting fires and about emergency response and what he wanted to do heading into office.
We are stepping up our game. I hear you. I get it. We need to do more and do better. These last 2 years have been devastating. 167 lives have been lost in fires or floods. Over 33,000 structures, if you look back over a 24-month period, have been lost in this state. Billions and billions of dollars of property losses. And we are at a point where everybody's had enough.
Sorry about that. I think the audio cut out. And so, on this first day in office, as you said, Newsom signed an executive order, and he wanted CAL FIRE to come back to him with recommendations on how the state could get its wildfire crisis under control. 45 days later, CAL FIRE came back with these recommendations, a whole series of them. But at the top of the list were these 35 priority projects, wildfire prevention projects, forest thinning, prescribed burns, that promised to treat 90,000 acres across the state, from the Oregon border, basically all the way down to San Diego County. And these projects have been sort of a primary talking point for Newsom when he discusses wildfire prevention and what the state has been doing.
Okay, so then two wildfire seasons behind us, about 2.5 years later, what are the results of these 35 projects?
Well, during those 2 years, Newsom has talked about these projects over and over again. It's actually how this investigation got started. We wanted to look at what was actually done on these projects and what has been done since then. And here's just a quick take or a quick flavor of how Newsom has boasted about these projects over the years.
One of the first actions I took as governor, quite literally the first week after I was sworn in as governor, was an emergency authorization to allow us to fast track 35 high profile fuels management projects here in the state of California. The purpose was to expedite
into the future. 35 high profile vegetation projects were completed earlier this year. We have expedited our environmental review to do the same. We have an historic partnership.
His work on those 35 high priority vegetation management projects that we identified that impact 200 vulnerable communities in the state of California. Their team delivered on all 35. They got those projects done.
Newsom has hung his hat on these 35 projects, as you heard right there. In January 2020, he declared victory on them. He said, these projects, quote, have collectively treated 90,000 acres. That would have been a huge increase in Cal Fire's prevention work. However, we dug into the data, and it shows that Cal Fire actually completed less than 12,000 acres. But Newsom said the projects treated 90,000 acres anyway.
All right, Scott, that is just a huge discrepancy. I mean, I think it, when reading your investigation, that's an overstatement of 690%. So why such an egregious gap in information and data?
We had reached out to Newsom's office multiple times, including with a detailed email that laid out all of our findings. We did not get a response back from them from our interview requests. However, Cal Fire Chief Tom Porter spoke with me for a lengthy interview, and he acknowledged that the figures cited by Newsom were incorrect. And he took responsibility for those misstatements by the governor. He essentially chalked it up to poor communication. He said, you know, Cal Fire needs to do a better job of not only educating the public, but also educating the governor about what treated acres means when Cal Fire does prevention work on the land versus a project's planned acres and what the scope, the original scope of a project might look like. Those 90,000 acres represented that initial project area, but it was significantly reduced over time. Now, again, you wouldn't have known that hearing how Newsom has talked about them and proclaimed sort of victory on them. Porter said that environmental review created challenges, and some landowners, some private landowners, they weren't always cooperating. There were also some natural geographic features like rocky areas that didn't need treatment. Those are kind of natural fire inhibitors. However, he also acknowledged that that doesn't account for all the acres that were not completed. Some of it just didn't get done.
So we're focusing on the 35 priority projects that the governor has brought up time and time again. But Cal Fire does a lot of wildfire prevention work on hundreds of other projects every year. I mean, they can span from a few acres to hundreds of acres. Did your investigation focus on those wildfire prevention efforts? And what did you find?
We did take a deep look at what's been done, not only with those 35 projects, but in general. Because there's a lot of other work that the state does on wildfire prevention. In 2019, when Newsom initially took office, those numbers spiked. We saw the number of acres treated during that first year in office actually jump quite significantly from Brown's last year in office. However, last year in 2020, the worst fire season on record, we saw fuel reduction and prescribed burns drop by half of what was done the previous year. And it's also worth noting that Newsom also cut the funding for prevention work in the state budget by about $150 million. And this year through Memorial Day, Cal Fire still remains below its goal of treating vulnerable acres, vulnerable pieces of land that are threatened by wildfire across the state. Here's what Tom Porter, chief of Cal Fire, had to say.
It's not something that I'm comfortable with. It is something that I am working to reconcile and to correct for the future. But we had an exceptional fire year. Everybody knows that. The same people that are doing that work on those fires, you know, their day job is to do fuels work and plan for fuels work. And that was not a possibility. And then with the COVID restrictions that we were having to keep our workforce healthy, we had a continued lull. And then this spring, we are seeing well above our five-year average fire activity that started in January and has continued to today. So the environment to do this kind of work has been very challenging.
I spoke to a number of fire experts, and they say, look, there's legitimacy to these reasons, to these explanations from Porter. Last year was a serious fire season that did spread Cal Fire thin. COVID-19 threw a serious curveball. However, it also shows the fragile prevention infrastructure in California and just how much it needs to still be built up and strengthened. Because at the end of the day, fire doesn't take a break because there's a pandemic or another emergency facing the state.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio's state government reporter, Scott Rodd, about his investigation on Governor Newsom's claims that the state met its fire prevention goals. So with that said, I mean, you mentioned that the budget was cut in half previously, but now the state has a record surplus. What does this mean for wildfire prevention? How much money is being proposed within the state legislature?
Newsom is proposing a lot of money for wildfire response and prevention. He's pitching over $1 billion for prevention and what he calls resiliency work. And that a lot of that's going to be going to fuel reduction, prescribed burns, forest thinning. And experts are optimistic. They say that this money really can make a notable impact. But there's a caveat. They say it can't be a one-time investment. Michael Wara of Stanford University's Woods Institute for the Environment had this to say about Newsom's proposed investment.
I see that as a very positive trend. I still think that we are not spending enough, that the significance of this problem for California justifies spending actually a lot more than we're spending right now. California needs a strategy beyond what can be done in a one-year budget for dealing with this problem. And we don't have that yet.
And as you mentioned, the state is enjoying a surplus of tens of billions of dollars. However, experts say it could be challenging when the state sees a deficit down the road. Will the wildfire prevention budget be cut like it was in 2020 when the state was looking at a potential budget deficit?
Right. So we've been looking in the past couple of years, but now looking ahead, California and federal governments, they have a goal of treating 500,000 acres across the state every year by 2025. Are we on track to hit that goal? Do experts even say that's enough at this point?
You know, currently we are pretty well short of that goal, and it's 500,000 both from the state and from the federal government. So combined, it'd be 1 million acres, which is a lot. It's more than we're doing right now, certainly. However, Cal Fire seems confident that this boost in spending that Newsom is proposing and that the legislature has also reflected in its version of the budget as well. Cal Fire seems confident that the state can reach its side of the goal with this funding, perhaps even a few years early. But experts emphasize that this goal doesn't mean much if it isn't sustained. This work has to keep happening. Scott Stevens, a professor of fire science at UC Berkeley, put it pretty bluntly.
Literally, if you're not going to maintain the funding forward, it's almost as if, why even do it in the first place? Maybe that's a little harsh. But if you don't continue this forever, you're basically never going to get out of this hole.
Forever. I'm going to hang on to that word. It's a sobering summarization of where we're at, how far we have to go, and how this work, if done right, really won't ever end.
Right. And this is coming at a time in the years we've experienced wildfire seasons essentially becoming year long. And that makes it so much more difficult when it comes to wildfire prevention. Before we leave you, Scott, were you able to talk to wildfire survivors? What is their sense of all this? Because this is impacting real lives here across the state.
I'm glad you brought that up, because ultimately we're talking, we're talking about, you know, government bureaucracy. We're talking about data that we've been digging into. But at the end of the day, the reason why any of this matters is because lives are being lost, homes are being burned, businesses are being destroyed, and people across the state, even if they can't see the flames, are breathing in hazardous smoke, sometimes for weeks on end. I did speak with some wildfire survivors, and they expressed frustration with some of our findings. Just, you know, the fact that Newsom had overstated just how much acreage was being treated, just how, you know, presenting the prevention efforts and the level of preparedness of the state. You know, when you see your home burned down or your business destroyed, it's hard to swallow that when you see that there's misrepresentation of what kind of prevention work may be done. And some of the people I spoke to kind of suggested that it reflects a broader attitude of politicians sometimes, of grandstanding, of speaking to addressing this problem. But when they look around in their immediate surroundings, they're not necessarily seeing those impacts, seeing the progress being made. So the overall sentiment was one of disappointment.
Scott Rodd is CAP Radio's state government reporter. Thank you for sharing your investigation with us, Scott.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Up next, we continue our conversation surrounding CAP Radio's new podcast series, After the Assault. We'll learn about the best practices for collecting evidence after a sexual assault and what's being done to make that process faster, which can reduce stress and frustration for survivors. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. This next conversation may not be suitable for all audiences. This week, we're dedicating time to CAP Radio's new podcast, After the Assault, which looks at what survivors experience in the aftermath of sexual violence and during police investigations. Today, we are focusing on evidence collection, including rape kits. As you'll learn in the podcast, the reality is 1 in 5 women have survived an attempted or completed rape, and that number can be higher for people of color and the LGBTQ plus community. Now, should a survivor choose to report, and that is an important piece in all of this, there are different types of evidence that can be collected.
At that time, there was so much I was trying to deal with, trying to get through, you know, going to the police station, trying to get myself through the evidentiary exam, trying to, you know, come home and make dinner for my kid.
Where he's like, well, you know, we're trying to build a house out of evidence, and like your emails are, you know, we need a foundation though, and you really have to build walls of the house. And you go on, I'm like, I get it, I know.
I went to the hospital and got everything like tested and got him to admit it via Snapchat message. I tried to reopen it, and that's when they said that there wasn't enough evidence from the beginning.
Data and evidence collection for my reporting became just that. It wasn't about listening to a survivor tell their story. It wasn't acknowledging a human being who had suffered a crime.
So one of the ways that prosecutors hope to build a strong case is through the use of DNA evidence, which can involve a meticulous medical exam that can be taxing and re-traumatizing. The examination process must be done through a specific kind of facility. In Sacramento County, this is the Bridging Evidence Assessment and Resources Center, or BEAR Center. It handles the collection of forensic evidence in sexual assault cases. Joining us now is Dr. Angela Vickers. She's the supervising physician of the Sutter BEAR program in Sacramento. Dr. Vickers, welcome to Insight.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. Well, the BEAR Center covers both Sacramento and Yolo counties. How many cases do you see per year?
We see about 500 cases per year. And many of the cases we see do come from Yolo and Sacramento County. That's about half of our volume. We also back up several of the other teams in Northern California for specialty exams or when they don't have 24-hour coverage from their local hospitals.
After a sexual assault takes place, what are the first steps in receiving health services and the option of having a sexual assault exam?
I think it really depends very much on where the survivor is as far as what their desires are, what they want to gain from having an exam done. There's two components of the exam. I think one is medically to make sure the patient's okay and perhaps to provide medications to prevent STDs and prevent pregnancy, including preventing medications to prevent HIV. That's the medical component of it. And that could be done by a primary care doctor. That can be done at a family planning clinic. It could be done in the emergency room, but usually it could be much easier done as an outpatient. And then there's the other piece that our team specializes in, which is collecting the forensics as far as DNA evidence and documenting the injuries that the patient may have related to what happened to them. We do both together at the BEAR Clinic, and we do it in a very supportive and compassionate way. And then we have the expertise that if needed later on, we can testify in court on behalf of the survivor.
Can you walk us through what happens during a sexual assault evidence exam?
Sure. So in most cases, the survivor would contact law enforcement and law enforcement would take a report. And then based on the timing of when the assault occurred and what happened to them, law enforcement would decide whether an evidentiary exam would be helpful for the patient as far as putting their case together. It's not always helpful in every case. Perhaps if there's a delayed disclosure like 2 weeks later, it wouldn't be helpful to have the forensic exam done. The patient comes down to our BEAR Clinic 24 hours a day. We take call from home and we'll come in after hours to see patients if that's what is indicated. We will always have an advocate with them. So the local county advocacy team that's also specially trained, and we work with them very closely, will also respond and be available to the patient to support them through the exam process or just to offer resources and a kind of kind and listening ear. We'll get the medical history. We'll get some information about what happened to them as far as the disclosure about the assault. And then we'll do a very meticulous medical exam looking for little bits and pieces of evidence, taking photographs. The last part of the exam does usually include doing a pelvic exam, much like a pap smear, and also taking a close look at the anus area if that's involved. We'll also do toxicology, blood and urine tests, looking to see if there's any drugs or alcohol in the person's system, because that often is a component of the assault, either without the patient knowing getting them intoxicated or coercing them into getting intoxicated before the assault. And then we take photographs throughout the exam process. It takes a while. It takes about 2 hours for us to get through the exam with the patient and support of an advocate or somebody else that they feel close to. And then we spend another 2 or 3 hours after the patient's gone packaging up the evidence.
That is quite lengthy. There are a number of steps in all of this. Where does consent come into play with each step? I mean, survivors have a very active role in this collection of forensic evidence, correct?
Yes. So we talk about consent for doing the evidentiary exam. The evidentiary exam is absolutely voluntary. It's never required of a survivor to go through the process of the evidence exam if they're not comfortable with that. If at any time they change their mind during the exam and want to stop the process or skip certain parts, skip certain questions, skip certain parts of evidence collection like the pelvic exam, they absolutely do not have to do those portions. But what we usually do counsel the patients is that if their desire is justice for what happened to them, or they're not quite sure yet and they think they may, that that may be a desire that they're interested in, we recommend that they get through each step as best they can, because the evidence that we can collect is very time sensitive, both looking for injuries and for collecting that DNA evidence. But in the end, it's up to the patient's survivor's decision about how they want to proceed with the exam.
How crucial is having a support person there during the exam? I mean, you were talking about having a loved one or a Weave advocate present.
Yes. So the advocates are tremendous support because they are professionally trained. They know about the dynamics of sexual assault. They spend a lot of time listening into what the patient's needs are and just quietly supporting them. They're not there to ask questions or do interview. They're really there just for the patient. And sometimes in a time of crisis, having somebody that you don't really know very well, that you can feel comfortable disclosing and not be judged. But also, some survivors prefer to have their best friend, a relative, a sister, to support them through the process as well. Usually we would allow one person with a patient that's a friend or relative as well as an advocate. But because of COVID over the last 2 years, we're limited to how many people we can put in a room and still keep everybody safe. So usually it's one extra person once we get into the exam room to be able to be with the survivor.
We're going to listen to one of the survivors who worked with CAP Radio's Sammy Cayola on this project after the assault, and she spoke about her experience getting the exam. Her name is Erin, and we're going to share just a quick excerpt of her describing the experience to some of the other survivors.
It made me, like, very uncomfortable. First of all, the bear exam is just very uncomfortable in general, like, all off top. It's right after your assault, and then they're opening you up and they're swabbing you. I did have a Weave advocate there, so that's what helped me feel a little bit more comfortable.
So essentially what Erin is talking about is what we have been chatting about over the last few minutes. What training goes into your team at Bayer to just make this process as comfortable as possible following a traumatic incident?
So, you know, in the last probably 5 years, I think all the sexual assault teams have become much more compassionate, but also more trauma-informed about the dynamics that a survivor may be going through and trying to meeting them kind of where they are. Give them choices about what options they have, speaking slowly and listening a lot about what the patient wants to get out of having the exam done. But there's absolutely no other way to explain, the process of having been assaulted violently and very intimately, perhaps the most difficult day of their life, and then be interviewed a few times about what happened to them, and then have to go, feel not that they have to, because they have some ability to decide what they want to do with their body, but then be asked to go through that process of evidence collection, which involves yet again instruments being put into their body in this very same place that they were assaulted. There is no way to really make that really easy for a survivor besides giving them the choices about letting them make the decision and, taking time and listening to what their responses are. But we all recognize that it's very, very challenging for them to do it, and that it's not the best choice for every person who's been sexually assaulted.
You know, the podcast also brings up, just a really important reality. We're going to bring in Erin again. Erin is a woman of color. She said that she was also uncomfortable with the fact that the nurse who did her exam wasn't very aware of how bruising might show up differently on different skin tones. So let's listen to her describe that moment.
I could tell where I had bruising, but I don't necessarily show bruising like that. So I know if you touch it, you're like, oh, that kind of hurt, and you know it's a bruise. But mine didn't show like the discoloration necessarily yet. There were some parts that did, so I was trying to show her on my arm, so she was like, oh, and she was like, I'll take a picture anyway. And then on my legs, I was trying to show her some bruising. There was some that did end up showing, so she took those pictures.
How do you help your staff understand more how visual evidence can look different on people of different races and backgrounds?
That is absolutely true. It's sometimes it's the darkness of the color of the skin. Sometimes it's an undertone of yellow, or, you know, olive colored skin that may be difficult to show bruises. And bruises don't always appear. Sometimes there's that tenderness and maybe some swelling that we can see on the physical exam, but it's very difficult to capture a picture of it for evidence. It doesn't mean that it's not there. So we have other ways besides taking a photograph of the injury to really document the injuries. That includes using a diagram to outline the areas where there's tenderness and pain. And then sometimes we bring a patient back a few days later to see if the bruise appears a little bit later. If it's a deep bruise, it may not be really apparent right after the injury, but after a few days, there may be some more bruises that we'd be able to photograph.
Finally, the window of time for these exams is critical. How soon after an assault should a survivor get this exam done, if they choose to?
Well, yes. We'll always say as soon as possible, but we can do the evidence exams up to 5 days following the last sexual contact. And part of that is DNA recovery. Goes down tremendously. The ability to recover the DNA goes down tremendously on about the third day. There's a little bit of evidence we might be able to collect on day 4 and 5. And then injuries are starting to heal. A lot of bruises will be completely gone after about a week. So the sooner we get the patient in, the more likely we're able to recover DNA. And then also related to toxicology, for a lot of patients or survivors who believe that they may have been drugged during the assault, there's a very short time window for us to really be able to pick up on many of the memory loss type of drugs, including alcohol, that may be in their system to be able to do that documentation.
Dr. Angela Vickers is the supervising physician of the Sutter Bear Program, which handles the collection of forensic evidence in sexual assault cases in Sacramento and Yolo counties. Thank you for spending time with us, Dr. Vickers.
Thank you very much. And I really appreciate being involved with the After the Assault podcast. It was very enlightening to myself and to a lot of the other team members.
Yeah, I think we all collectively agree with you on that. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're going to continue our week-long conversation surrounding CAP Radio's new podcast series, After the Assault. We're turning now to CAP Radio's data reporter, Emily Zentner, who submitted many, many records requests for data surrounding sexual assault cases. While there were a lot of requests that went unfulfilled, she took what she was given and was able to compile the data that was used throughout the podcast series After the Assault. Emily joins us now to help us understand the rape kit backlog throughout California and how Sacramento County compares to the rest of the state. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Emily, there's already a lack of data surrounding sexual assault cases because, for one, not everyone reports. I mean, how did you try to overcome this obstacle of getting the data to help tell this story throughout the entirety of the podcast series?
I think the big thing for us was just being transparent. You know, a lot of people don't report their sexual assaults to law enforcement, but we knew that by looking at people who did report their sexual assaults to law enforcement and did go through with a rape kit exam, we can understand the outcomes for the people that do go through that process. And I think that gave us some insights into those perceptions of the system that might be preventing people from reporting. So I think it's kind of a whole system, a whole ecosystem that we were able to get an idea of by looking at what data was available. And, you know, we just made sure we were really clear throughout the podcast that this doesn't represent every single person who's been sexually assaulted.
Yeah. And also, you filed just dozens and dozens of requests over the past, you know, couple years. So really, I mean, just kudos to your tenacity throughout all of this. Well, can you walk us through, looking at Sacramento County, walk us through what you first found out when you made the request for this data within Sac County?
Yeah. So around rape kits in Sac County, we actually, through talking with Dr. Vickers, were hearing a lot that Sacramento County really doesn't have a rape kit backlog, much of one, and that the majority of kits are getting tested. And so we requested that data and found that that was true. From 2014 to now, Sacramento County has been testing and processing the majority of its rape kits. And it's really just a handful of kits that aren't getting processed each year, like 1-6%, just, you know, just a few of them. And, you know, we don't want to minimize the frustration for anyone who's had a kit done and, you know, it didn't get tested, because that's a totally valid experience. But it, you know, it really was notable because there's that perception that rape kits aren't getting tested and that if you get a rape kit done, it's not going to get tested. And that is just really not the reality in Sacramento County. The DA's crime lab tested every single kit it received in 2020 out of 250 it got.
Now, is this a recent development or was there a shift in recent years within Sacramento County?
Yeah, it's been kind of a story of different grants and processes. And before 2014, fewer kits were getting tested, more in the 60, 70, 80% range. And, you know, there were, you know, a lot of reasons for that, for things that were changing over the years.
Yeah, I think what's just so important, what we learn and just are really reminded of throughout this podcast series is, you know, we're talking about a handful of kits that are not being processed within Sacramento County, but each one represents a person, a human being. So why do those rape kits go untested by the DA's crime lab?
So what the DA's crime lab told me is that there are a lot of reasons that that could happen. It could be that the victim recanted. It could be that the defendant has already been sentenced in that case or in a different case. It could be that the case was closed or that the kit was from outside the county. So they, you know, maybe forwarded it on to that county's crime lab instead of testing it themselves.
What's the timeline that a rape kit needs to be processed under?
So there's actually a timeline mandated by state law in California. Labs have 120 days, which is about 4 months for, you know, so you guys don't have to do that mental math. And so they have about 4 months to process rape kits and deliver a report to law enforcement. And Sac County's average turnaround time was a lot faster than that. So in 2018, they turned around kits on average in 76 days, which is around 2.5 months. And in 2019, it was 59 days or around 2 months. So in Sacramento County, they're, you know, they're doing it even faster than what the state mandates.
You know, that's moving in the right direction. But I can imagine for a lot of survivors, 59 days, you know, is still painfully long.
It definitely is. And that's something that we wanted to help with in this project is explaining the system so that maybe people can understand that it's normal for your rape kit to take 59 days to be processed, because we heard from a lot of survivors that, you know, they just didn't understand. They thought it wasn't happening. And so I think, you know, being able to educate people about the system can help save some of that, you know, that pain of wondering what's going on and if it's happening.
Emily Zentner is CAP Radio's data reporter and part of the After the Assault podcast. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing all your hard work over the past 2 years.
Thanks, Vicki.
Well, you can learn more about the importance of DNA collection and the other evidence that could be used in a sexual assault case by listening to episode 3 of After the Assault. We also have a step-by-step guide for reporting a sexual assault, a glossary of terms and support organizations. We have all of that at capradio.org/afterTheAssault. Still ahead, we dive into how much the drought is affecting California's agriculture. You can join the conversation, too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. In Sacramento, we're known as the farm-to-fork capital of America. With rich, fertile landscape across the majority of the state, we rely on water to grow the food we eat and distribute worldwide. But as we know, California's experience with droughts is recently familiar and more frequent. This year, 41 counties are currently under emergency drought conditions, as declared by the governor. Temperatures have already been in the mid to upper 100s, and summer just kicked off on Sunday. So, if you've also been to some of the lakes in the area, even the rivers, you just have noticed how water supply is extremely low. The images are just heartbreaking and devastating when you look at our reservoirs and lakes. This has led also to some farmers to rethink what they grow and how to manage their land. So here to help us understand why this drought is different and how farmers are adapting is Josue Medellin. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Merced. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Quite a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. Starting off, how is this drought, what we're experiencing this year across California, different from the last years of drought that we've recently experienced as a state?
Yes, this is multi-year drought. This is the second year. Last year was drought two. But what is different is that this time, some northern areas in the state, such as the Sacramento Valley and the North Coast, are dry too in the map. This is important because water from the Sacramento Valley is used as a source for agriculture in the state, in the Central Valley, and also is used for delta outflows and use in cities in south of the delta. So what is different also is that we now have the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that requires groundwater sustainability in basins and keep a check on how much water is pumped.
Farmers grow many crops in this region and throughout California. I mean, we're a very big slice of the agriculture pie. And you are at UC Merced, which is, you know, really the heart of that. What are some of the conversations taking place among farmers about water conservation and adapting to this?
Yes, well, our state has been very innovative in implementing lower water use systems in agriculture. So that's for the past few decades, high efficiency irrigation systems have been adopted. And but when we think in water use, we need to think in a water balance perspective, in a water and mass balance perspective. Some part of this water goes to recharge the aquifer, some part goes to runoff, and sometimes evaporates from the soil and also from the crop. So when conserving water is being adopted for the past few decades. But some of the non-recoverable losses need to be paid attention on, such as the evaporation from the soil. So conserving water from the soil might be a good option. In terms of what to grow, some crops use more water than others, and we're not in a position on prescribed cropping patterns, but hard trade-offs have to occur between what to grow this year because water is much more scarce, and some commodity groups might have some harder time making a business case to acquire water through the various systems.
Well, going off of that, there are larger conversations and arguments being made that it's time for us as a state to rethink what we can and can't grow in California. I know you can't prescribe what to grow and not grow, but with your expertise, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the fruits, nuts, and vegetables in the state provide roughly 85% of all the crop value, in the state, and jobs too. So following land from some of these commodity groups might have higher economic implications or rather economic implications. And also some of the lower value classes serve as feed crops. And beef, cattle, the dairies are large commodity groups that provide a lot of value, maybe 25% of the value of the total agriculture in the state. So they serve to these sectors as well. So we need to think in terms of water value per unit of water applied. And in many of these commodity groups will have a hard time making a business case in the future if water becomes scarcer.
Right, because value can be looked at differently. There's the value of water, but then that's also tied to the economy and jobs as well.
That's correct, yes.
You were talking about groundwater as a viable option and what's being discussed. What are the challenges with the groundwater supply?
Well, as you said, groundwater provides a buffer for droughts. So in the past multi-year drought, farmers recurred to increased pumping to compensate the shortages from surface water. The problem is that there's been a pervasive overdraft of water, so of roughly 2 million acre feet per year in the San Joaquin Valley. So that is roughly 50% of the supply to agriculture has been overdraft in water. Now, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act prevents that from continuing and requires groundwater basins to achieve sustainability by 2040. So that is, there's a gliding path occurring there. So in don't get me wrong, when there's a drought, groundwater is there to help to replace the surface water losses. The problem is that it has been overdrafted, and that overdraft needs to be reduced or eliminated by 2040. So in this drought, we will see some more attention to what is being pumped, because now it's part of the groundwater sustainability plan of some agencies.
And we're talking about water how it applies to agriculture, but you know, there's this whole ecosystem here in the state that involves urban environments and cities, and there is a tug and pull with that. What adaptations should occur when it comes to cities and the impact of water supply that agriculture depends on?
Yes. Well, cities use about 10% of the total water supply. Agriculture uses another 40, and the rest is environment and not accessible water. So cities, roughly 40% or more in some places is outdoor use. So there's some room for adaptation to drought. In the last multi-year drought from 2012 to 2016, the cities were really successful in reducing total water use upon mandate. And in most of the places in California achieved that. So cities are well equipped for that. The problem is really rural water systems that rely on shallow wells that, due to some overpumping, might result in might see some dry wells that provide water for communities that are oftentimes lower income or disadvantaged.
Yeah, there is, you know, just increasing conversation that this is kind of becoming the norm, and we should expect this and plan for this. These really dry periods during the winter months, where we rely heavily on what hopefully is water supply and in runoff, but in this case, it fell way short. With your experience, what are your overarching concerns about the drought that we're currently experiencing in the years to come?
Well, these reservoirs are kind of low in many places, are roughly like 40, 50%. In Southern California, reservoirs have some good amount of storage. However, it's what it will happen if the drought continues next year. So cities have to be attentive of, in agriculture and water districts, water agencies have to be attentive of what do they keep in the reserves for next year. So some of these, cities will, or some irrigation districts or water agencies have announced cutbacks. So that is likely to occur. And we might see some reduced pumping as well, and to prevent some more painful losses next year.
Finally, it's always a good reminder, what can we do at an individual level?
Well, we have done quite a lot in terms of conserving water in the last drought. So we have also adopted a lot of low water use appliances at home. cities, in particularly in the southern part of the state, have mastered really conservation and reduce substantially per capita use. So be mindful of outdoor use. Outdoor use is probably half of what we use in our homes, and when adopting low water use appliances, things like that.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to outdoor use, drought tolerant plants as well, and landscaping.
Well, it's a matter of taste, but we might see it more in the future.
Josue Medellin is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Merced. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much.
Bye. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or really wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director, Mark Jones, and our engineer is Stephen Starbuck. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.